Coming up on the program today, a little bit of the global economy, a little bit of the prom economy, and a whole lot of the American economy. How you get from where you are to the American dream. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Friday, the 17th of April. Good as always to have you with us, everybody. No use wasting time, so we won't. The past 5 days in business and the economy in just 4 minutes. It's a little thing we do called the weekly wrap. The stars of the show today are Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine and John Carney from the Wall Street Journal. They are in our studios in New York. Hey, guys.
Hi, Kai.
Hi.
All right. So, John, you're very close to the microphone, man. Back up just a tad. That was a lot of John Carney right there. So, listen, here's what I want to do. We're going to run through a bunch of stuff. Item one, John, is inflation at the retail level came out this morning. Also, consumer sentiment came out. Both were up, which is basically good. We want some inflation and we want confident consumers. Yeah.
Absolutely. You know, we've been in a serious risk of actually slipping into deflation.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a good sign that, you know, demand is up, pushing prices up. That's good.
John sounds more tentative than he usually does here, Lee. Or what do you think?
Well, at least he's saying it's good. I do think it's good. And I think what's happening is we really did have this terrible, brutal winter, here in the Northeast, which and a lot of the country. And I think that I really think we're sort of spring loaded to kind of, you know, see some growth from here. I do think there's some pent-up demand.
All right. So with that as preface then, John, thinking that the American economy is doing all right, I'm looking up at the television in my studio right now. It's your former employer, CNBC. And the headline there in front of a whole bunch of red on the markets today is Global Worries Rock Stocks. Now, first of all, that's a very Variety-ish headline. But, but second of all, I don't want to talk about the markets. I want to talk about the global worries, right? We got the World Bank and the IMF in Washington for spring meetings. Greece and contagion are being used in the same phrase. Talk to me about the global setup here, man.
Doesn't it feel like we've had this conversation
so many times before? I was trying not to say that.
There's a serious concern that Greece is really having to scrape the very bottom of the barrel to come up with cash.
Literally running out of money, right?
Right. Mm-hmm. They are running out of money, which is a ridiculous thing to happen in a modern economy.
Well, yes.
But we're back to the possibility of, could Greece have to leave the Eurozone again? We thought we had gotten past this. We're not. Greece doesn't have the cash to pay its debts. And so the possibility of a Greek default is once again back on the table.
All right. So, Lee, I'm just going to go ahead and say right here that I don't actually believe Greece is going to get either kicked out or have to leave the European Union. But if I'm wrong, somehow, gasp, I know. What happens here?
Well, first of all, I agree with you.
Yeah.
I don't think it's going to happen, but it would be really disastrous. It would be it wouldn't be so bad for Greece. It would be really bad for the EU because you have many other economies that are, teetering and that might say, well, wait, maybe we should do this too. And there goes the whole experiment. And I don't think it's wrong to call it an experiment. But I think if there's a deal, I think they stand a really good chance of not defaulting and coming out of it. But they really need a deal. And it's really tough right now.
And we should say just quickly, John, I mean, Europe as a whole, altogether, the European Union is our largest trading partner.
It's very important for us that the European economy does well. If it doesn't, it makes it much harder for the U.S. economy to do well. We need global demand for our goods and services. And if they have a serious meltdown there, we'll definitely feel it here.
All right. Topic number three, Lee, and we're going to bang through this one quickly. And it is a little bit about the stock markets today accepted. Etsy went public this week. The craft place Party City went public this week. It is a good time, I imagine, then for companies to be saying, hey, listen, give us some capital.
Well, it isn't. It isn't. I mean, the actual pace of IPOs is lower than it normally is, and the conditions are pretty good. And so you have to wonder, why aren't more companies going public? And one of the reasons is because there's so much money in the private markets these days. I think that's a little too long for you, but, it's really a big deal.
It's true. A lot of people say, look, why would I go public? I can get money from venture capitalists and other private market investors. And they're literally just forking it over. Some of these companies that are going public, it's almost mysterious. You ask, well, why would you go public when you could just take $200 million from, every VC on the corner?
All right. Because that's what they do. They hand it out on the corners. That is a conversation for another day. John Carney from the Wall Street Journal, Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine. We'll see you later, guys. Have a good weekend.
Thanks, Kai.
You too.
All right, bye-bye. I am not a betting man most days, but I got $5, five American dollars that says when we get there, it's going to be the Wawa trombones. Ugly all the way on Wall Street today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. If you've ever seen a picture of a trading room or a trader's desk, you've noticed, I'm sure, all those screens they've got, all covered in flashing numbers and colored charts, sometimes six of those screens in front of one person. Chances are real good that those screens are connected to a network run by the financial data company Bloomberg, of the former New York City mayor of the same name. It's his company. And if you've ever wondered, by the way, where he got his fortune, it's because Bloomberg Terminals, as that network is known, rent for a reported $24,000 a year. I mention all that not just because it's nice to know, but because today something went quite awry with that network. It basically shut down, not for all that long in the grand scheme of things, but long enough, just, for instance, to force the British government to postpone a big bond auction. You wouldn't be totally wrong if you said for just a few brief moments the financial world ground to something of a halt. Marketplace's Dan Weissman has the story of what happens when that happens.
Bloomberg is not an absolute must-have for Steve Bombardier. He's a trader at Conifer Securities. It's just really, really nice to have.
It's such a powerful tool. If you're watching, you have a list, and then you right-click on the list.
Bam! News, stock prices, trading volumes, company filings, all in one place, organized however you decided to set it up across a bunch of screens. But for a lot of traders, Bloomberg is a must-have because unlike Bombardier, they rely on Bloomberg for chat. And for traders, chat is very different than it is for you and me.
That messaging system has become a critical lifeline for many people within the industry.
That's Douglas B. Taylor. He's a consultant to financial data companies like Bloomberg and competitors like Thomson Reuters and Dow Jones.
Bloomberg messaging has become a pipeline for many people to what might be the best liquidity pools or the largest number of potential counterparties.
Meaning, for some traders, Bloomberg chat functions as a kind of virtual trading pit. For those traders, a Bloomberg outage is like trying to organize 20 people to go out to dinner and your phone stops working. Matt Turk is a partner at First Mark, a venture capital firm.
It's like being shut out from the rest of the world, right? It's like you suddenly don't have information flowing in and you have nobody to call.
So during the outage today, a lot of traders just sat around. Some got onto Twitter, where one offered a suggestion in case this kind of thing ever happens again. CB radios and carrier pigeons. In Chicago, I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
The German luxury car makers BMW, Audi, and Mercedes-Benz reported record global sales during the first quarter of this year. It's a bit of a turning point for a slice of the car market that is built traditionally on notions of exclusivity, because as entry-level prices for those cars fall, more and more buyers are getting themselves a piece of fine German engineering. And as Marketplace's Adam Allington reports, that does come with a few risks for the companies involved.
It used to be the case that owning a luxury car was something to aspire to. Megan Molly is a marketing director with Huge. These days, luxury car makers are even targeting millennials buying their first car.
They're more concerned about keeping you in the fold and making sure that there's something there for each of your life stages. And that's really where they're headed with respect to the marketplace.
Molly says lower starting prices and a broader range of models may translate into higher sales, but it also risks diluting the brand's cachet.
They are now competing against the Hondas and the Fords of the world. And frankly, often those other vehicles can really beat them on options and pricing.
That's where marketing comes in. If would-be buyers still believe that BMW equates with, say, performance, then being more mass market is actually a good thing.
They really preserve their brand messaging, even if they're trying to produce cars that are less expensive.
Tomai Sardari is a professor at NYU's Stern School of Business. She says the mass market strategy won't work for every luxury car brand.
Cadillac is a brand that had a lot of cachet a few years ago, but also it was associated with people of a specific type and background, perhaps much, much older.
Sardari says Cadillac needs to cut back its offerings and go upmarket to firmly reestablish itself at the top end of luxury before going back downmarket to attempt a larger slice of the pie. I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
Here with two words you might not have expected to hear on the program today, prom season. They are brought to us by this amazing statistic from Visa, the credit card people. The average teenager who goes to prom this year will spend, wait for it, $919 in the process. That is a whole lot of money, both for prom goers and the small businesses that outfit them. And yes, we are talking mostly the girls here. And that has led to an interesting opportunity, a prom registry, so that no two girls from the same high school show up wearing the same dress, much like, I don't know, wedding registries or something. Elizabeth Holmes wrote the story for the Wall Street Journal. Hey, Elizabeth.
Hi, Kai.
Help me understand the business model here, prom dress registries. It seems a bit convoluted. I don't know.
Well, let me tell you that when I went to prom a million years ago, this was not a worry of mine. I worried about a lot of things as a teenage girl.
Right.
Well, it turns out that today in 2015, Hollywood tabloid red carpet culture, where we play games like Who Wore It Better? And so these girls
yes, we do.
Do not want to show up at prom and have the same dress as somebody else. And so a lot of these formal wear boutiques that operate sort of in the higher end prom dress business, so several hundred dollars for a dress, they are offering a service to their customers by saying, we will keep a log of all the dresses we sell, and we will not sell two of the same dress going to the same prom.
Obviously, this is some kind of upsell, right? You give us an extra $50 and we'll put you on the registry?
It's a free service for most of these places that I talk to. Yes, they do this sort of as a way to lure shoppers from, you know, all the places you can buy a prom dress online. So a lot of these are small businesses that are starting it, but it doesn't mean that their registries are small. I talked to one massive formal wear boutique out in Silicon Valley, and they keep track of like 600 high school proms.
Wow.
So they have this massive computerized dress registry where they're tracking who is wearing what to which prom.
Okay, but then there's a problem, right? Because let's say girl A goes into a store, finds this dress she loves, buys it for $400, hello, and then, you know, 2 weeks later, girl B goes into the same store, finds the same dress, goes to buy it, and then the store person has to say, oh, yeah, no, in our registry, this was already sold. You can't have it. Seriously?
That's exactly what happens. And as you can imagine, it's a pretty emotional moment for the girl who is denied. The shop owners that I talked to said that although that moment is not necessarily pleasant, in the long run, most shoppers come to appreciate that they're trying to make sure that everybody has their own sort of special and unique fashion moment come prom night.
I have a 16-year-old son. I think he's going to prom. I'm not sure. Is there a tuxedo thing going on here that I have to worry about, or am I good to go?
Well, you're off the hook. So I did not find any tuxedo registries out there. But guys then have the added burden a lot of times of the promposal, which is, you know, the elaborate way that people are getting asked to prom these days.
And that's another thing that Visa says. Wedding proposals are hard enough.
Well, this is like a whole social media element, so you can show off. People are spending, I guess, several hundred dollars on the promposal alone. So, and that onus often falls on the boys.
Oh, man. Okay, back to the women. Back to the girls for a second. Are stores doing this in you got to figure it's a vague hope, right? That these girls, when they grow up, will come back for bridesmaids dresses and wedding dresses and that whole smash?
Yes, they're hoping that it builds this kind of long-term loyalty. A lot of it is a play for the parents. It's the mom or the dad that's coming in and writing the check or, you know, whipping out the credit card. And the parents want this sort of added security, too. They are dealing with a dramatic teenager, and they don't want to have come prom night, you know, tears if someone else had my dress. And there's not just prom. You know, I mean, if you go to a high school with a slate of formal dances, there's homecoming, and I've heard of winter balls and things like that, that these formal wear boutiques, especially in sort of more limited markets, they need that repeat business. And so they're hoping that they'll get you for your whole high school career. And then should you become a bridesmaid or should you become a bride, that you'll keep them in mind.
Amazing. Elizabeth Holmes is a senior style reporter for the Wall Street Journal. Elizabeth, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks, Kai.
Coming up.
We know there's decently high rates of social mobility for immigrants. I think from an immigrant's perspective, it's a place that's kind of always been known as this land of opportunity.
In other words, the land of the American dream. But first, let's do the numbers. There we go. There we go. Saved myself $5 right there. U.S. markets took a part in a global drubbing to end the week. Thank you, China and Greece. The Dow Industrial's off 279 points, 1.5%, closed at 17,826. I'm sorry if anybody took that bet out there. The NASDAQ knocked off 75 points, also 1.5%, 49.31. The S&P 500 off 23 points, 1.1%, finished at 2,081. And no, I don't get to pick the numbers music. For the week, the Dow and the NASDAQ both off 1.3%, the S&P 500 off 1%. What if the one word of advice Benjamin Braddock heard in The Graduate had been aggregate? He might have had a good day today at Summit Materials, a big supplier of sand, gravel, crushed stone, and other aggregates. It gained 6.2%. Bond prices rose as well. Yield on the 10-year T-note thus fell 1.86%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. Runners compete in the 119th Boston Marathon. Pulitzer Prize winners are scheduled to be announced. And she's got a long list of credits from King Kong to American Horror Story. Oscar winner Jessica Lange turns 66. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We spent some time yesterday on the program talking about, well, talking loosely, I guess, about the American dream, about upward mobility more specifically, and how there is a bunch of research out there that shows somebody's chances of climbing the economic ladder in this country, especially if they started at the bottom, depend on a whole lot of things that are mostly beyond their control. Our wealth and poverty correspondent Chrissy Clark took us out to Dayton, Ohio, to show us how where you grow up, how good the schools are, for instance, how economically integrated the place is, can have a big impact. Today from Dayton, once again, Chrissy explains there is one group of people who are startlingly good at moving up, no matter where they're from.
I went to Dayton, Ohio a few weeks ago because I'd been reading about just how bad people's chances are of climbing out of poverty there. The Dayton metro area has one of the worst rates of economic mobility in the country. 40% of kids who grow up poor stay poor. And I met plenty of people around town who were not at all surprised by this statistic. They'd seen or lived it firsthand. But I also met this woman, Amira Yusuf, who lives with her family in a poor neighborhood on the east end of Dayton. When I asked her, do you expect your children to do better than you financially?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Especially my oldest son. He wants to become a doctor. Then after he finished, he will have a lot of money. Then this time I have to relax and sit and he pay money for me.
That's your plan?
Yeah, this is my plan.
Amira literally laughs in the face of her city's dismal statistics on economic mobility. Then again, Amira laughs all the time, a big infectious laugh when she talks about a difficult exam she's about to take in one of her night classes.
What is it in?
Finance.
Or when she talks about how poor she was in Jordan, where she lived before she moved to Dayton, way too poor to own a car.
In my home country, I do not have a wheel of car.
Not even one wheel.
Wheel.
But back to Amira's particular jolliness about the odds of her family escaping poverty. Sure, she may be naturally optimistic, but she also may be on to something. Even though her family started with almost nothing when they moved to Dayton 5 years ago, they had a few things going for them that make their odds of achieving that proverbial American dream better than most poor Daytonians. For one thing, they're immigrants.
There's a lot of evidence out there that the United States is a pretty good place for immigrants.
Nathan Hendren is a professor of economics at Harvard who's been studying rates of economic mobility across the U.S.
We know there's recently high rates of social mobility for immigrants. I think from an immigrant's perspective, it's a place that's kind of always been known as this land of opportunity.
To understand what can make many immigrants' experiences so different when it comes to getting ahead, let me tell you a bit more about Amira and her family.
Now you gotta, hi. Here comes
When I visited their home one afternoon recently, her daughters were playing that classic American basketball game, Pig, in the back alley. From that vantage point, out on the street, the house they live in, a unit in an old two-story bungalow, looks like most of the houses on this street. Kind of run down, a crumbling set of concrete steps leading up to the porch. But where some might see signs of poverty, the Yusufs say they feel rich relative to where they came from. Amira was born in Kuwait, the daughter of Palestinian refugees. Her husband is from Iraq. Both fled to Jordan during the first Gulf War, where they lived in uncertain immigration status, and life was hard.
It's hard to find a job. It's hard to feed the family. Everything's expensive there. Finally, my husband, he said, there is no future for the kids.
In Jordan, she and her husband lived in a crammed apartment with their four children. Amira's 13-year-old daughter, Malaf, says compared to that world, their new home in Dayton...
It's bigger.
You have more space.
Yes, yeah. A lot.
Still, when the Yusufs came to the U.S. through a United Nations refugee program, they were a little worried about what they were getting into. Amira says when she first found out they'd been randomly assigned to Dayton, Ohio, a place she'd never heard of, she Googled it.
I learned that Dayton, it's a poor city. You cannot find a job. The life is hard there.
And yet, the moment she stepped off the plane after a 17-hour flight and walked into the Dayton airport...
Then I saw, like, American lady.
It was a woman from the charity that was sponsoring Amira's family.
She said, hi, are you Amira? I said, yes, I am Amira. Then she said, I am Gretchen from Catholic Social Services. I am your caseworker. You cannot imagine. It's really, I feel like finally God sends angel to us to help us.
The help came in many forms. Local church and nonprofit groups helped them find a house, helped with the first few months of rent, donated furniture and clothes and appliances. But even more than the physical support Amira's family received from the various community groups, what may have been more important to their hopes for upward mobility was being tapped into these groups in the first place. Nathan Hendren, the Harvard economist, calls this access to social capital.
Right. So social capital, you generally can think of that as trust or measures of civic engagement. To what extent do you live in a community as opposed to just a collection of individuals?
Research shows that in many cases, immigrants build special forms of social capital as they connect with other families from their home country and form cultural and sports and religious organizations together. And Hendren says there are lots of ways social capital can help promote upward mobility.
Could be through role model effects, could be through actual connections that a broader community can provide as opposed to just your own parental background.
That can partly explain why some immigrants are able to climb the economic ladder faster than other low-income people around them. But there's another really important reason why families like Amira's have higher rates of economic mobility. Amira and her husband may have been poor, arrived in Dayton with almost nothing, but their family did have one key thing, education. Amira's husband was trained as an engineer. Amira has a degree in computer programming. At first, that didn't seem to matter in Dayton.
My major is computer. I tried to apply for everything. I cannot find a job.
They both ended up with relatively low-paying jobs in a college cafeteria, way below their qualifications. Her husband as a cook, Amira.
Cleaning, wipe the table, washing dishes.
But when I go visit her at that same cafeteria...
Would you get Amira? This lady would like to see Amira.
Where she's now worked for more than 4 years.
What does your tag say? Production
manager, yeah.
She's been quickly promoted, partly because she had so many untapped skills. And that's the thing. People often look to immigrant success stories like Amira's and say, if her family can climb out of poverty so quickly, why can't anyone? Here's Nathan Hendren again, the Harvard economist.
One thing to keep in mind is that it's not clear that you necessarily want to compare them to the next below median income family there in Dayton. You know, there's a lot of things that are potentially different about that immigrant family. They have a very high educated background, a lot of different opportunities afforded to those parents in their backgrounds.
And Hendren says that's true for not all, but many of the families who immigrate to the U.S. As for Amira and her family, coming to this country was a dream come true.
They call American dream of land.
The land of dream.
Land of dream, yeah. See, then this has really happened. I agree. This is really right. It's you can like your dream become real.
In Amira's case, her son, who already has a scholarship to Ohio State University, could have a pretty good shot at becoming a doctor. And once she finishes those night classes she's taking, Amira might be able to start teaching again. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, which comes to us courtesy of the Sony hack of a number of months ago, specifically the WikiLeaks publication of a whole stack of Sony documents this week. Buried deep in there was one from Harry Friedman. He's the executive producer of Jeopardy, who was, I guess, looking to grow the program's revenue. So here is what he wrote. This is a quote. After 13 years, Alex Trebek has grown back his mustache. We have a plan to take advantage of the seemingly never-ending interest in his upper lip and monetize the interest that will be generated when he shaves it off again. So yes, we are looking for someone, he wrote. Gillette, Dollar Shave Club, Harry's, Schick, Bic, to be the official razor of Alex Trebek's mustache. End of quote. Never did go anywhere near as I can tell, which is kind of a pity, right? I should grow a mustache just to see what happens, right? But, man, it's radio. Never mind. All right, the Dow off 279 points today, 1.5%. The NASDAQ off 75 points, also 1.5%. The S&P 500 down 23 points, 1.1%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace was developed by J.J. Yore. Tommy Andres is the acting senior producer. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer around here. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you next week, everybody. Have yourselves a really nice weekend. And, oh, yeah, this is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.